You know, most people talk out of their own interest. Well, this is an interest of mine. And would you believe it has to do with sailing? And this is a chapter. This is a chapter in the book of Acts. Very famous chapter. And again, I hope I'm not reading into. I hope that what I have to say is out of and not into the passage. But who knows at this stage of the game. I want to read. It's going to be a fairly long reading. And I'll hop around a little bit if you wish to follow. It is in chapter 27. And I'm just going to pick up about verse 7. And I'm going to go as fast as I can to get to the end of the chapter. This is the story of the shipwreck. As a little bit of a background, Paul is on his way. He has been put under the charge of a Roman centurion, Julius. And they're making their way now to Rome. And they've left Caesarea, Sidon. They've gone up on a coastal ship, smaller ship. And finally, they've hooked up with one of the large grain boats that carried grain from down in Egypt up to Rome. A fairly large boat in the sense that there were 276 people on board as well as the cargo of grain. Now, that seems rather large. As a matter of fact, I would call it large. But it wasn't the largest of the boats that go on. Josephus is not always reliable in terms of numbers. He must have been a fisherman because he had a way of getting those numbers maybe a little bit bigger than sometimes they were. But supposedly he sailed on a ship with 600 passengers one time, virtually on a similar kind of trip like this, headed toward Rome. And he also was shipwrecked, by the way, in the Mediterranean. So, a fairly large boat, but not one of the largest, depending on the numbers, etc. So they get on the large grain boat, and then they're having to tack across the Mediterranean. You can't just leave one end of the Mediterranean by sail and zip it up to Rome. On a sailboat, you have to go according to the wind, and the wind determines when you sail and where you sail. And so they are on this boat, and they're headed up this way. And when we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty, the wind wasn't right, they weren't making much headway. We had arrived off Cnidus, and since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salome. And with difficulty, notice these words coming out, it was not easy sailing. Sailing past it, we came to a certain little place called Fair Havens. It was a little harbor, not a good harbor. It was not a good place to winter. But they were considering staying there. And when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them. In other words, it was now into October, and it was not good to sail in the winter months on the Mediterranean, especially when the winds would come up and be more variable. It was not good to be out in the open sea during this time of the year. Paul began to admonish them. And he said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, and not only of cargo and of the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, for spending the whole winter there, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there. And if somehow they should reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing northeast and southeast, and spend the winter there. And when a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had gained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close inshore. But before long, there rushed down upon the land a violent wind, and the technical wording here is a north one-third east wind, out of a particular corner, a very storm-type wind, a northeasterner kind of a wind that we would call it. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. If you know anything at all about sailing, in doubt or danger, head into the wind. The best way to lose a ship in a storm is to ride with the wind to your stern. You have no control whatsoever. And this is what happened. They lost control. They were being driven by the wind. And running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. Again, if you do any sailing, you know that most sailboats have a dinghy, a little boat that they pull along behind them. Well, this, in all probability, was the ship's dinghy, the one that they went into shore on. They were scarcely able to get it under control. And after they had hoisted it up to put it on board the boat, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship. And fearing that they might run aground off the shallows of Stark, they set down the sea anchor and let themselves be driven along. The next day, being more violent, storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, and from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. Trying to go fast to get it all in. And when they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, a little nanny, nanny, goo-goo. Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. And yet, now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of the Lord God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, stood before me and saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island. And then it goes on to say that they were sailing 14 days. They were approaching some land. They took some soundings for the depth of the water, etc. And fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. Now, again, if you've ever been in a boat in a storm, you have something of a feeling of what's being talked about there. And as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea, on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from your head, from the head of any of you, shall perish. And having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. And all of us in the ship were 276 persons. And I'll stop the reading there. To me, it's always interesting how we glorify, deify, as well as label as saints, the people of the New Testament. And I enjoy teaching a Sunday school class every Sunday at Second. And one of the things that I enjoy most of all is pointing out to people that most of these folk in the New Testament were just plain people too. They were not these little gods that we sometimes make them into being. I just think it is super good that Paul had to say nanny, nanny, goo-goo. I just thought that was really good that even somebody like that would want to point out that had you done it my way, it would have been all right. Those kinds of feelings come up. Now, stirring in with this is the process that somehow or another we think that biblical characters walked around with this God man in their ear. We have walk man. We heard some talk about those kind of things, you know. Well, it's like we think they walked around with a God man in their ear, with their set tuned in, and they were told everything to do and everything to say. Well, walk mans get you in trouble, and to think about them as having a God man in their ear is also to do something to these people. They were human beings. In this passage, I really believe you see three things at work that affect and influence all of our lives. Number one is what I would choose to call good old, plain old common sense. Secondly, I think you really do see someone receiving a direct word from God, the miraculous taking place. And thirdly, I think you see faith being acted out. And frankly, those are key ingredients in mental health. And they certainly are key ingredients in our spiritual growth and development. To back up then, the fast was already over. It was October. It was not the time to go sailing. It's interesting that the sailing that I like to do down in the Virgin Islands, you don't go sailing down there in July and August and September. Now, you can understand why now that we have these nice big weather maps and these all-weather stations that will give you the satellite pictures of the whole hemisphere, because during that time of the year, inevitably, you're going to see a hurricane down there somewhere. As a matter of fact, when we go sailing, one of the things we like to do is either snorkel or scuba on the wreck of the Rhone, a British mail packet that was down in there in the Virgin Islands in about 1855, 60, somewhere along in there. A hurricane came up, and something like 200 people drowned on that boat when it was driven ashore on Salt Island. And now you can see it laid out on the bottom. The visibility of the water is clear down to about 90 to 100 feet. And so you can see the big drive shaft of this old steam boat down there. It's a fun thing to look at, but it's a spooky thing to see. The last time we were down there, we had the experience of sailing through a squall. And it was a fairly severe squall. And we all put on life jackets. We got out the tiller, so if our power steering on the boat, the hydraulic steering went out, we could still handle it. Had to shorten the sail. And at that moment, you realize how you are at the discretion of the wind. And you see the clouds rolling up, and you see the cold water blowing on you, very warm temperature down there. But you begin to feel something of the threat, if you want to use that term, the power of nature that it has, and how little control you have over that. Paul was aware of these things. He tells us in 2 Corinthians 11:25 that he had experienced shipwreck three times in his life when he wrote that. This was not the only time that Paul had sailed on a boat, nor was it the only time that he had been shipwrecked. He was a fairly knowledgeable person about travel. He had gone around the Mediterranean. He had traveled by land. He had traveled by sea. He was one who had some experience in the whole process. And so when they got ready to make the decision about wintering in Fair Haven, remember now he's a Roman citizen, the centurion consults the leading people on the trip, in all probability. And he says, hey, what do you think we ought to do? Well, Paul, you traveled an awful lot. I've gotten to know you that well anyway. What do you think we ought to do? And Paul uses some good old applied common sense. And he says, well, frankly, this is August and September in the Virgin Islands, and we don't go sailing at this time of the year. We better stay here. He says, this is past the fast. We're going into the winter part of the year. You do not get out on the Mediterranean. The winds are not dependable enough. We better stay right here. Although Fair Havens is a little bitty harbor, it's not a good place to spend the winter. We'll be better off staying here. As a matter of fact, if we leave here, my prediction is we'll lose the ship, we'll lose the cargo, and the people will die too. He makes no claim for that being a revelation from God. He makes no claim that this is what the Lord has told me. All he says is, I perceive that this is what will happen if we sail now. He uses common sense and experience to pass a judgment on what may or may not happen in this situation. Damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion has a higher responsibility. That is, he is the one who has play and decision in whether or not the ship goes on or not. So he talks with the pilot, and he talks with the captain. He talks with the owner and the guy who is in command of the vessel. Who wants to winter in Fair Havens? Who wants to spend the winter there? You know, who wants to stay in Biloxi when we make it to New Orleans for the winter? You know, that kind of a feeling is present in this passage. We're going to be hung up for 4 months here, troops. So look, golly, can you imagine being in this little Fair Haven all this time? Hey, let's give it a try. We've sailed this thing before. We're going to make it. No big deal. And because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there. And so as soon as a little south wind blew up, they would move them along. They cautiously got out of the harbor, sailing close to land, very, very cautiously. And no sooner did they stick their nose out than, to use the proverbial American expression, all you know what broke loose. And what happened was the hurricane hit. the storm hit. The tornado, not over water, but the huge, big storm hit. The probability is that the storm hit and carried them along roughly 500 miles across the Mediterranean. I was talking with a guy, Memphis has a naval air station there in Millington, and I talked with a guy who was on a carrier in the Mediterranean 3 years ago. And the fleet sailed through a storm like this. And his statement was that they were in the storm for 2 days sailing through it in an aircraft carrier now, okay? And destroyers and everything else around them. And his statement was, and I'm not trying to say this happened in this passage, but he's talked about being on the carrier and looking out and seeing a destroyer over there and seeing the wave go down and the destroyer being hidden from his view. And then it would rise up and the destroyer would come up so that he could see the screw, the propeller on the bottom of the destroyer out of the water. I'm not saying that that's how violent this storm was, but I am saying they have those kinds of storms in the Mediterranean. And it took them 2 days to get through it, so he said. I believe him. He had no reason to lie about it. I've never been through that kind of a storm, but they were going through it. Paul and this ship were being carried along by it. So however bad it was, they simply could not handle this storm once it started, a violent storm. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. If you've ever lost control of a boat, you realize that, you know, now, by the way, we had a diesel inboard. So anytime you face bad weather, you turn the old key downstairs, hit the button, and get the diesel going. So you have some power. Once you lose headway in a sailboat, you go dead in the water. And you have no control over where that boat goes at all. The wind blows the boat. As a matter of fact, the wind going over the mast even will sail the boat in a violent enough wind. Nowadays, oftentimes the boat is built so that it will head up on its own. Just the way it's structured in shape, so it'll pull up into the wind. That was not the case here. So the wind is driving them along from the stern. They have no control over the boat. They're not heading into the waves and cutting through the waves. They're riding like this on the waves and being tossed and thrown. It's frightening to me. If you can ever get the picture of what's happening here, no wonder they didn't eat for 14 days. Who would want to? But then they got behind the little bitty island of Clauda. The wind was blocked momentarily. It calmed down slightly. The first thing that they do, they go into their emergency procedures. Get the dinghy on board the boat. We can't lose it. That's our way of getting off of this thing if we need to. So they pull it in. And then they, by hand, lift it up and get it on board the boat, lash it down. As soon as they get that done, and the way Luke talks here, it almost has the flavor and the feeling that he himself strained at the rope pulling it up. He was involved in what was taking place. They get the dinghy up. They hoisted it up. They use supporting cables and undergirding the ship. One of the things that has been discovered about sailing technique in that day and time was that when a wooden ship like this got into a violent storm, one of the dangers was that the ship would come to pieces. They didn't have all of our nice plastics to build boats out of. They didn't have solid hull boats. They didn't have the resin glues, etc. So when the boat was involved in a violent storm, they had cables ready, a rope, throw over the bow, come back till it fit real snug, like the metal straps around a barrel. They'd throw it over, it would come back snug to help hold the ship literally together. And so as soon as they got just a little bit of calmness in the storm, they got the dinghy on board boat, they threw the cables over to hold the boat literally together, and then there's some confusion about the next thing that they did, but the probability is that they lowered a part of this tall mast, the running sail, and lashed it down on board the boat. They were getting it as ready as they could for the storm that they knew they now must ride out. The die is cast. There's nothing else to do. And so, they begin to ride out the storm. They throw out a sea anchor, perhaps, something simply to slow them down, that may be the interpretation of the rigging. They throw out, they do something with this part of the boat. There's a little bit of unsureness about it. So they let themselves be driven along. The next day, they were being violently storm-tossed, and they began to jettison the cargo, throw it overboard. Again, a boat in this kind of a storm would have to start taking water. They could not keep it watertight. And so as it would begin to take water, it would get lower and lower in the water. And so they would fear from being swamped, and they start throwing the cargo overboard. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. They also, the grain cargo, they began throwing, but they also throw the spare mast, to use a term that may or may not be accurate, but the extra rope, everything else they had on the board that they could get away with, getting rid of, they get rid of. And the storm is on them. And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, and from then on, all hope of being saved was gradually abandoned. That is a heavy, heavy scene. That is dramatic. That is life-threatening. In the midst of all that, Paul stands up and says, "Nanny, nanny, goo goo." Boy, he just couldn't resist, and I told you so. You know, I won't make any family comments about that, but you get all sorts of little analogies that come out of that. Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not have set sail from Crete. But nevertheless, an angel of God, an angel of the God that I serve, of the Lord God Himself, came to me and said that not a person on this ship will lose life. That is a potent statement. "Do not be afraid, Paul," is what the angel says. "You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told." Imagine yourself on this boat, 3, 4, 5 days into the storm. You haven't eaten this whole time. Your stomach is upset. We have a little thing in Memphis called Liberty Land. They have the Revolution, one of these roller coasters where you do the loop and you go the spiral thing. Imagine being on that for about 2 or 3 days. Imagine the pitching and turning and being thrown about and your stomach up here and down at your knees and back and forth. Imagine Paul standing up on the Revolution and saying, "Do not be afraid. I think this thing's going to stop one of these days. God told me last night He's going to throw the master switch and let us coast into a stop." Oh, well, no wonder they don't get that much encouragement from this process. You know, "Paul, the storm is raging. Your God may be somewhere, but He's not on this boat." You can almost feel that coming. The common sense has been applied. Don't make the trip. Now the angel of the Lord comes and says, "No, Paul, your common sense was that you'd lose your life if you set sail, but I'm going to take care of the lives. Not a single person will be lost on board this boat." But when the 14th night had come, But when the 14th night had come, and as we were being driven about in the sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching land. Do you know what ambivalent feelings are? A mixed blessing. This was an ambivalent feeling, mixed message right here. On the one hand, "Please help me get to land." But on the other hand, "Good grief, don't get me there too hard and too fast." Now, they're about to hit some kind of land. They can tell. But are they going to be driven ashore on some rocks and pounded into smithereens? Are they going to be able to beach the boat and get off? The old mixed feeling is taking place. You know, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. You know, yes, that's what I want, but I'm not sure I want it right this way right now. I want it in the daylight. I don't want it at dark." They were hoping and waiting and wishing for daybreak to come. They take the soundings and they tell they're getting closer and closer to land. And then we find the human nature at work. Imagine passengers on board the boat, and imagine the crew. And imagine the crew getting together and saying, "Hey guys, there's only one dinghy." And as that centurion and all those prisoners, and all those other cats making this trip. You know, if we get in the dinghy, the odds of our living go up dramatically. We're close to land. We can tell that. The water's getting shallower and shallower. Let's get in that dinghy and get off this crazy boat. We don't owe them anything. This boat belongs to them, not to us. Why should we risk our lives for all those people? Here, 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 here. And as the sailors, the crew of the boat, were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea, the dinghy, on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow. They have stern anchors. They have the fore out. They're going to lay something out from the bow to try to hold the boat steady in position. Keep it from turning around so, being driven so. That's the pretense. What they're really doing, they're leaving a drowning boat. Then Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved." Is that divine inspiration? Did his God-man earplug come on again and the voice of God says, "Hey, Paul, they're about to mess this thing up. Don't let anybody get off the boat because either you do it my way or you don't do it at all." I don't believe that. Anybody with a grain of sense knows that if the crew abandons the boat, the passengers can't sail it if they haven't been doing it before. My contention is that that is pure, raw, Christian common sense. He looks out and says, "We need the crew to get the thing beached." To the centurion, "Hey, look, if they abandon the boat, there's going to be nobody to help us get it into the beach like it's supposed to be done." Now that makes sense even to the centurion. Granted, at this stage of the game, he probably does have a good relationship with Paul. They've been traveling together for a while now. Paul had been in Caesarea 2 years. He may have known this particular centurion for a long time. I don't know about all that. It isn't just raw faith in Paul's God that makes him do what he's about to do, in my opinion. This is purely my opinion. The logic of what Paul is saying, the common sense of what Paul is saying, is very strong and very heavy. And that is, if the crew leaves, we may not make it. God's told me that we're going to make it, but these guys are about to blow the whole thing. And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you've been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food. Not a hair from the head of any of you shall perish." My view of Paul is that he was probably an obsessive compulsive personality. He is so attentive to detail. His mind is so like a steel trap, so logical, so concise. He does attend to detail. He writes late at night. He does all sorts of things. He's constantly traveling. He's constantly doing what he needs to do. The beauty of it is that most obsessive compulsive personalities are not warm. The obsessive compulsive personality in its rawest form tends to be a cold person. The beauty of Paul is not in his purity, but it's in his attention to detail with intense warmth and care for people. A unique quality to this individual. He didn't always have that little walkman with God talking to him every time, everywhere. He was attentive to God speaking to him, true. He was dedicated wholeheartedly. He had been attentive to detail all along. And so Paul is ministering to the crew. I can see him, the boat bouncing on the waves, not making as much headway now because they have the anchors out. They may be holding a little bit. It's slipping anchor and going along slowly. I can see Paul scurrying from one part of the ship to the other one. You don't just walk across the boat, you know, and say, "Hey, how you doing over here? Can I help you out a little bit?" You hold on tightly. You grab and hold. You don't try to demonstrate your masculinity by walking upright and not holding anything. You're not macho at a time like that. I see him going from this group to that group, comforting, encouraging all the way from that point in the night until daybreak. I see him doing this. And even before day comes, I see him finally standing up. Now, it's not daybreak yet. They don't know what land is out there. It may be rocky. It may be sandy. They don't know what's in front of them. All they know is that for 2 weeks they haven't eaten. They're dead tired. They're worn to a frazzle. They don't have the energy to swat a fly if one could stay in the air in this storm. They're there. They're standing. They're hurting. They're tired. They're weary. And Paul stands up. And again, it's not pulpit-like with the Bible in front of him like this. But he does stand up and say, reminding them that God has said, not a hair of your head is going to be lost. Take some food. You need to eat. It was an act of faith on their part, even to eat. They gave up hope of being saved long ago. But now they partake. Paul reminds them that his God has said they will survive. And in this reminder, he acts out that faith by taking bread and breaking it and eating it. So he has faith, but it's faith that is translated into behavior. Daylight has not come. They don't know what's out there. But in doing this, Paul has been saying all along that God is going to preserve them. Is it possible that faith coupled with just a little smattering of behavior is the thing that encourages the people enough for them to take the food to eat? Is it possible? Is it possible? He took the bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. The rest of the story is the ship is driven ashore. It doesn't make it all the way into the beach. It probably is driven into a sandbar type thing, a mud bar. The front of the boat sticks tightly, and the back of the stern of the boat is being pounded to pieces by the waves. No, the storm had not calmed down that much, but they are able to make it ashore. They are able to survive. As we think about Christian living, so many times people want to live according to their own insight and let that be that. So often people want to live as if God will tell me what to do, I will do it. If He doesn't tell me, I'll wait for Him to tell me. And then so often we want to have faith, but it's the faith that comes when you know what's in front, not when you know who's with you. And in this passage you really see, in my opinion, the common sense being used based on experience and understanding of what's going on. But you also hear God coming to and telling. But then you see the faith being acted out and the effect that it has on other people when you act out faith. And Paul acted out faith. And Christian living then. Many people, by the way, take this. David talked about allegories and allegorizing passages. Many people take this as an allegory of the Christian life all the way through. I don't want to do that with it. But I do want to understand that we need to use sanctified common sense based upon experience. We need to be open to the Word of God as it comes, as it is given to us. So that is a guide and a direction. But we also need to act out faith to influence others. Having faith is one thing. Living out faith, in my opinion, is something else. And faith, in my opinion, is something you live. It's not something you possess. Paul lived it, and it had a positive effect. As we leave here, please go in the light of knowing that God has given you a mind to use so that we can use all the disciplines and trainings that we have experienced throughout life, engineers, attorneys, whatever else we have here. The knowledge of how to do certain things. It is a wholesome thing to use your head. It is a good thing to use that common sense. Know that God has spoken. Be attentive to that. Be attentive to the best understanding we can get of it. And try to get that understanding. But perhaps the most crucial element of all is to live the faith so that people can see it and be drawn to it. So that people will be encouraged by that living of the faith.